This is Sean Holland.
Don Granger.
And today is April 2nd, 2005. Let's begin. All right. Just wanted like some general background information on your life before the war.
Oh, that'd take a long time. Yeah. I was born and raised in Miles City, Montana, in 1920. That makes me almost 85 years old in September. I went to school there, graduated from high school, and of course at that time we were right in the middle of the Depression. And to get into college was very difficult. So I went into the CCCs and spent a year there. And then when I came out, I went to school in Helena. It was a school of aeronautics. Practically all phases are able of aeronautics except for flying part of it or something like that. From there, I went to work for Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach, California. And the war broke out at the time I was there. Pearl Harbor happened. And the man that was in charge of the department I was in kept telling me, oh, don't worry, we'll get you an deferment. I decided I didn't want a deferment, but you couldn't enlist down in California. There was such long lines waiting for every service under the sun. So I asked the draft board to give me an extension and came back to Model City and was able to enlist in the aviation cadets. This was in August, and it wasn't until February of the next year that they called me for service. Now, where do you want me to go from there?
All right. I got a couple, like, what did you think of Germany and Japan before the war started? Did you care much about them? Or?
Well, I didn't have any thoughts about Germany. Japan, of course, is the only thoughts that I had about them was all the cheap stuff that you got from there, and all the junk.
So kind of like China now type thing?
Yeah, well, same difference, yeah. Only I think China does a little better job now. Japan did. At least Japan was not copying every products that were here. It was just stuff that they made on their own.
All right. Did you get any, like, outside, did you care much about the war news from Europe or anything?
Well, of course, everybody knew that England was having a hard time and that we were helping them. And I think everybody agreed with that. Basically, people were not, to my knowledge anyway, were not gung-ho about getting into it. So they were pretty much in favor of what FDR was doing.
All right. Let's see. Oh, well, we kind of went over this. What were you doing when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Well, it was a Sunday afternoon, and I was in my sister and her husband lived in California, and they'd come down and pick me up, and we were going someplace. I don't remember where we were going, but we picked it up on the car radio. Kind of spoil everything for the day.
Yeah. All right. Okay, what was your family's response to Pearl Harbor?
Well, naturally, with two sons of military age, they were very upset about it. My sisters, I had four sisters at that time, and an older brother, older than the two of us, and they just thought, well, that's what you got to do, that's all.
All right. See, there's a couple other questions here. I might not ask you all of them. How did you feel about Jeanette Rankin not voting for the war?
No opinion. I don't. I figured one woman, what do you know? It didn't bother me any.
Yeah. And then we already got, why did you enlist in the military? But we kind of know that because you were.
Well, the main reason was I didn't want to be drafted.
Yeah. All right, then we got here, what were your family's and friends' reaction to you signing up to join the military? I kind of just...
What do I want to say? My mother was not disappointed, but she wasn't happy about it. My father said, you got to do it. And so there was never any hesitance about, oh, you shouldn't be doing this, you should do something else. And I had an older brother who was 4 years older than I, and he enlisted in the Navy. Enlisted in the Navy, spent 4 years in the service and never was on a boat. He was with Naval Intelligence.
All right. Okay, now your basic training.
Basic training, I was in the aviation cadets at Santa Ana, California. I don't remember how long, but we were within the class I was in. We were within two weeks of graduation. We'd already been measured for uniforms and everything else. And then the word came down, you got too many guys in there. We haven't got place for them, so we got washed out. I think there was probably about 75% of the class that got washed out. So he went before the commanding officer and he interviewed you and said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't want to leave the Air Force. And he said, okay. So they sent me to gunnery school in Harlingen, Texas. Gunnery school, and actually it was bombardier training. But and from there we went to Salt Lake City and made up a crew. There we went by train clear across the United States, Louisiana, for flight training and B-17s. I might be getting ahead of myself there. But.
All right. Was it what you expected, the training?
Yeah. It didn't bother me. The only thing that really bothered me was between gunnery school and going to Salt Lake. We were at Fort Worth, Texas, and they'd get us out on the parade ground every day, and there was about 4 inches of dust on the parade ground. And they give you one drink. We had a sergeant there that had been in Africa or someplace that would stand by the water fountain and you'd take about two swallows and he'd kick you in the rear and get you out of there. That was the only thing I didn't like about it. I thought we were... I don't like to use the word mistreated, but I guess that's what it was.
All right. Were you kept aware of world affairs during the training, or did they keep you?
You had access to everything that, you know, was going on, the same as anybody in the public was. I don't think we were aware of anything else other than what the public was getting.
All right, we already went through what you like the most. What do you like the least about training? What do you like the most about it?
Flying.
See. All right. Did you like meeting people from other parts of the country?
Yeah. You know, as long as there was still in the service, there was still this Yankee and rebel attitude, but I got along with them. We didn't have any arguments.
Yeah, so did it create any tension? You kind of say that?
No, the only place that created tension was when we were in Louisiana, and there was a guy, my best friend was from Indiana, and the other one was from California. And we got on a bus one time and went and sat in the back row, and the bus driver wouldn't go until we got out, moved out of the back row and got up front. And we thought he was pretty chicken, but then...
All right. And then we got, what were your expectations as you were getting ready to leave basic training and go into the regular service?
You mean to go overseas?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was with anticipation. I wasn't wanting to stay back. In fact, I guess you'd say I was looking forward to it.
All right. Let me get to the... All right. We're getting to the battle.
Battles.
Right. Now, would you describe like an average mission on a B-17?
Well, I'll tell you, be perfectly frank with you. The first mission that we were on... Well, let me back up a bit. We flew over. We took a 17 and we flew over. We went to Bangor, Maine. We went to Greenland. We went to Iceland, where we got stuck for a week and a half there because of the weather. Then we flew to Ireland. They took the plane away from us. And then they put us on a ferry boat and took us across the channel. And then we got on a train and we went clear across England to Rattleston, which was the name of the station. We no more got there than the bombardier got sick and was put in the hospital. So that stopped us for a while. And we took one flight, just a training flight. No combat or anything like that in it. And unbeknownst to us, our pilot and I think it was the co-pilot were flying missions as a spare. In other words, somebody couldn't go, so they took their place. And they didn't let us know anything about it. We thought it was kind of chicken that they didn't wait for the rest of us and do it all at one time. But anyway, to get back to the first mission we had, it's what we were supposed to take off at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was almost 8 o'clock before we got off the ground. We no more got off the ground, we lost an engine. And shortly after that, we crash-landed the plane. Three of us, ball gunner and the tail gunner and myself, got out.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know how I got out. When I came to, I was standing about 25 feet away from the plane, and it was, and the ammunition was going off and everything else. And the tail gunner, which who wasn't hurt, was yelling at me to get the hell out of there. And well, I finally went over to where he was at. Didn't realize I'd been burned until I started to crawl over the fence and saw this all hanging down around my fingers. And he says, it's gonna blow up. And so we all ducked down into the ditch, and when it went off, it knocked all of us out. So that was our first and last mission. I spent 4.5 months in the hospital after that.
Yeah, this kind of leads me to one of my other questions. What were their arrangements at the hospital in England? Were they good or bad?
Well, I thought they were excellent. This was a station hospital, which was not... Well, you go to a... We went right to one because we were in England and it was accessed right to the station hospital. Otherwise, you probably would have went to a first aid station first. But we went right to a station hospital. One memory that I have, I was laying on a gurney outside the operating room, I guess, or whatever. And this nurse came by and took a look down at me. She says, "Oh my God." Turned around and walked away and came back with a towel and put it over my face. Practically my whole head was, broke my nose. All this was torn loose. It was burned. My head was burned. I have a scar up here where the machine gun hit me in the head. My hands were burned. The only thing that saved me was that I had an electric suit on.
Yeah.
And electric suits were made out of asbestos. So the rest of my body was pretty well protected, at least for a while. And so I spent, like I say, Hospital care was wonderful, I thought. The head surgeon there was a major from New York City who had been a plastic surgeon in real life. And I still think to this day that he kept me there longer than necessary so that he could do plastic surgery on my hands and everything. So, in fact, he wanted to rebuild my ear, and I told him no, I had enough. So anyway, I spent 4.5 months there, and like I say, the nurses, and you just couldn't ask for anything more.
All right. Well, then, what do you do with the downtime? Like, this is before the accident, so, but your downtime, like, when you were waiting to actually go on missions?
Well, you couldn't leave the base. Although my friend Harrison and I snuck out one night and went to a pub about 4 or 5 miles from there. It was pretty easy to do. There wasn't that many guards around or anything. In fact, to go back a bit, I have a book at home where this crash of ours is written up. This guy was in the Air Force at that time, and this is what he kind of wrote on afterward. His theory was the PDOT tube, which indicates your airspeed, had been sabotaged by Germans. That there were Germans around the bases and German spies, and that wasn't really the cause of it, because we lost an engine. It was on fire when we crashed.
Yeah.
But it was possible that there was that was going on. We had an awful lot of crashes on takeoff. And if you don't know the airspeed, anything could happen. But anyway, to get back to what we did, played poker. Rode bicycles all around the base. We'd go down, and my friend and I, and we would go down and watch them take off in the morning, and then come back and watch them come back, because we wanted to know what we were looking forward to. Red Cross had a hut there, had some magazines. And, by the way, that's something else I'll tell you about the hospital. The only bad part about the hospital was the Red Cross. They had an office, and this other buddy of mine in the hospital, he had one hand and I had one hand that we could use.
Yeah.
We were going down to see somebody else at another morgue, and we saw this Red Cross room, and it was full of magazines. But we'd never seen a magazine all the time we'd been there. So we went in and said, hey, how about getting these magazines out? Well, we don't have any way of taking them around. I said, well, you got a cart there. He's got a hand. I got a hand. We'll do it. Then they wanted us to bring them back. I said, I'm not bringing them back. I said, those things went from one hand to the other. I said, we practically wore them out. So anyway, we figured we might get court-martialed, but we didn't.
All right. Well, just kind of idea. What friendships did you make while you're flying missions and kind of over
there? Well, of course, best friend was, like I said, Harrison from Indiana. He and I were both about the same age. We were older than most of them. In fact, I think we were even older than some of the officers. So that we had a lot of things in common. But he was married, had a young baby, and which was the bad part.
All right. Because you got a Purple Heart, I assume.
Yeah.
Were you proud when you got the Purple Heart? Or?
Well, I was laying in a hospital bed when the guy came in and pinned it on my pajamas. I don't know whether I was proud or not. It didn't mean that much.
Yeah.
All right, now go to describe your duties as a flight engineer.
Well, a flight engineer would see that the plane is properly maintained. Of course, the ground crew does most of that, but before flight, well, you would go through all of the flight preparation mainly. So that's very, it was very simple. Like I say, the ground crews did 75% of the work.
All right. Now, just to talk a little bit about your marriage in England.
Yeah. When I got out of the hospital, they were going to send me home. And instead, I went to a replacement depot. And while I was there, a colonel in charge of all the replacement depots called me. And he talked to me and he said, I'm going to get, he was an old World War command pilot. And he says, I'm going to get an airplane. And he says, I need somebody to crew it. Well, there was a choice between me, who had been in combat, and a young kid that had just come in and got sick and got left behind by his crew. And so he says, you're willing to stay? And he says, for 3 months temporary duty. Okay, better than nothing, you know. So anyway, it ended up that I was with him for almost a year, over a year. And we went through two airplanes. We grew to the point where we had a stat controls after the D-Day. We had a stat control center in Paris, and we'd fly records and that over to Paris. We would take a few high-class officers down to Monte Carlo for for rest. So it was duty that I wasn't about to give up.
Yeah.
But most of the pilots that we had were ones that had been to combat. Were on their way home, and they'd do 3 months. Well, first one only did 3 months. And the second one, he and I got very close to each other, and he kept saying, okay, I'll stay another 3 months, another 3 months, and another 3 months, until we were there over a year, the two of us. By the way, he was killed in a mid-air collision, or not mid-air collision, but he ran into the side of a mountain flying some corporation's plane.
Yeah.
So anyway, when I was in this replacement depot, I was put in with administration guys that were there, permanent party.
Yeah.
And the one guy that I bunked with was going with a girl in Hanley. Mm-hmm. And he kept after me, come on in, you should see her cousin. She's a nice gal, you ought to come in here. And I said, finally I gave up. Mm-hmm. Went in to see her with him on Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas.
Yeah.
Her mother and her aunt actually owned a fish and chip shop, but her mother, Marion's mother, would go down there and help out. Mm-hmm. And so that's where they were when we went and met her. And it was okay, you know, she was a nice girl. Went back again, and I invited her to a dance that we were having out at the camp, and things just grew. And maybe I was hooked because she always says that after I left that first night, she said, told her mother, she says, I'm going to marry him. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a chance.
All right. Now, you kind of brought something up before. You flew officers to Monte Carlo and stuff. Mm-hmm. Who was the highest ranking officer you ever took anywhere?
Two-star general, took him back to London. He'd been up an inspection trip or something, and we didn't, we had Doolittle and Spots, and who was the other guy that came? Of course, they were good friends with our colonel because he was been through World War One and everything. I don't remember the guy's name. Can I say he was an asshole?
Okay. Must have been exciting to talk to Doolittle, though.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I've got a picture of them coming out, just getting out of the staff car and coming into everyone's spots.
Yeah. All right. All right, now, here's another. Did you get much outside news about the status of the war when you were in England?
Nothing except what the regular radio stations would have, in which that was pretty much censored.
Yeah.
So you didn't get much. The only real news that you would get would be from a group coming back after a bombing mission and how they felt they had done. Yeah. One we were supposed to go on was to Leipzig.
Oh, here's a question I always wondered. What was the food like at the base?
We always ate good. I'll tell you where the worst food was, and in Ireland. Egads. We spent about 4 days there waiting for transportation to England.
What part of Ireland were you in?
Belfast. And it was just, in fact, it was just outside of Belfast. We slept on straw mats. The food, the breakfast I can remember is what they call sausage. It was nothing but oatmeal, it seemed like. Ground up, make look it's like sausage. Real thin, they cut, in fact, my wife still tries to do that. Cut their bread real thin.
Yeah.
And it's almost paper thin at times. And a lot of boiled stuff. Boiled vegetables, boiled potatoes. We didn't get too much meat out there. At the base, we were fed real well. Real well.
All right.
And of course, when I went to work for the colonel, flying him, first sergeant of the mess hall was a mess sergeant. Became a very good friend of mine, so we had an understanding. Yeah. But it was good food.
Can I go in there? Yeah. All right. Let's go over here. All right. Where were you when you heard the war was over?
I was in Stone, which is where I was based with the colonel. I had been up to see Marion up to her house, and when I came back down to Hanley to catch the bus, there was two other guys from my outfit there, and they had just heard it. And there was a Bobby standing there, and we were kind of hooping and hollering, and so we grabbed him and threw him up in the air and carried him around a while, and that's when I heard about it.
Yeah. All right, and how did you feel? Were you just excited? Or?
Just glad, yeah. I wasn't ready to go home. not with having a wife there and everything. That would be before I got married. But we didn't get married until August of 44. Anyway, mixed emotion.
Yeah. All right, what were your expectations once the war was over?
Well, I had a job waiting for me, because when I had been in high school, I had worked for a hardware store, and when I was there waiting to be called into service, the my former employee came to me and wanted me to go work with him, and I said, no, I said, I want to do something different, so I got a job as a night watchman or baggage man or whatever it is on the railroad. I'm load the baggage and I load the baggage off of that. It was a 11 to 7 job, so it made it kind of easy to have a lot of daytime. I guess I just knew I was going back to Mount City and would get a job, wait for Brian to come. That was...
All right. What was the trip home like? Was it...
Well, I could have flown home. And I decided, because I'd made such good friends, in fact, the first sergeant was my best man. And so I decided to go home with them. They were going home on a boat, but they sent us over to Le Havre, France, to get the boat. We sat there for 8 weeks, because what they had done is they had instituted a policy where if you were in the service overseas and volunteered for another tour, they'd send you back on 30-day leave, and although the boats were going back with guys that had signed up for that, and it was wintertime, no October, November, December. We finally got on one of these Kaiser boats, whatever they were, transport boats. The bunks down in the hold were 7 high, and just rows of them. It should go enough room for you to get through. And we hit a storm right out of England. We'd been just half a day, and we hit a storm, and it was not pleasant.
Yeah.
Guys just sick all over the place. And I think there was 5,000 of us on that boat. When you went to eat, you had to go up out of the hold, across the deck, and down into the other hold where the mess hall was. And when you got to the top of the steps, there was an MP standing there. And as soon as the boat went up the air, rolled, and they let some of them go and stopped the rest of them, so nobody got washed overboard, I guess. And the food lacked a lot of substance. The last a day and a half before we landed in Norfolk, Virginia. By the way, we went clear up around by Iceland and that, trying to get around this storm. So where we would have been about a week, we were almost 2 weeks. The last meal we had was a day and a half before we landed, and it was an orange and a cracker. That's all they had left on the boat for each man. So.
All right.
I had more trouble getting home than I did anything else.
Yeah. And you went over here. All right. How'd you feel about leaving your friends from the war?
Well, I still kept contact with them for a while, and then, like everything else, most of them lived on the East Coast, and one main friend that I had had been killed. In fact, my best, save electricity, my best man, the first sergeant, lived in Pennsylvania. So it was kind of hard keeping track. You know, you got busy doing your own thing, and I think he moved and didn't let me know where he went. So.
All right. So what was the first thing you did when you came home?
My folks, that's all. Well, the first thing I did, I got discharged at Camp McCoy, Wisconsin on Christmas Eve. And very fortunate in the fact that I had a sister that was living in La Crosse, Wisconsin then. So I grabbed a bus and went there and spent Christmas, spent 3 days with her, and then took the train home. Nothing. Mm-hmm. No big celebration or anything.
Yeah. All right. How did your family react when you got home?
Oh, they were real pleased to see me. Thankfully.
Yeah.
Of course, they had received a telegram when I was in the hospital.
Yeah.
And that I'd been wounded. Mm-hmm. And so I had pictures taken to send home, mm-hmm. so to make sure that they knew that I was all in one piece, yeah. and so forth. So they were very thankful to see me.
All right. Well, was the community different? Like Miles City, was it the same or different than when you left?
Well, like I said before, I had lived in California for 2 years. Yeah. Had been in school away from home for a year. Been in the CCs for a year, so really, I couldn't tell you whether there was any change or not, because it's one of those things that was, every time you come home, something had changed.
Yeah.
One thing that I remember coming home on leave one time, and I went to the grocery store with my mother, and I was standing up in front talking to somebody, and they brought a cart full of bananas up. The fruit was all in the front of the store. Cartload of bananas up there. Man, I'm telling you, we almost got killed. Women jumping on all of those bananas and grabbing them. My mother was mad. Oh, she was mad. You were standing right there and you didn't get any. So she didn't get any bananas. But we still ate well.
Yeah.
You know, it was rationed to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Well.
All right. How was civilian life like much different than once you'd gotten out of the military? Was there a big adjustment or not?
No, not for me anyway. I laid around for, well, I got out at the end of December, and Marion came just shortly after the 1st of April. So, and I just wasn't going to find a job or anything else till she'd come. I had a job waiting for me wherever I wanted it, because I had people in town saying, well, come on, go to work for me, go to work for me. When I did take a job, I went with a friend who had a mint store. And I decided I'd had enough of hardware for a while. I lasted 3 months. I got so sick of putting the pins back in the shirts after some woman had taken all the pins out and shook the shirt out and laid it back on the counter. Mm-hmm. I went back to work for the hardware store.
All right. So this kind of asking, what was the most difficult adjustment when you came back?
I think probably the biggest adjustment I had is getting used to people again. Mainly because they were so self-centered and, you know, just like the bananas.
Yeah.
You know, I got to get mine, I got to get mine. Just didn't seem to be the comradeship that we had when we had the service.
Mm-hmm. So. All right. What did you receive any benefits when you came back? Like any?
Well, I had a disability, so but it took me a long time to get it. They start out fooling around with 10%. You go and have another exam, and then, we'll make it 15, and so on and so forth. It was kind of chicken.
Yeah. All right. What about the war made the biggest impact on you?
I guess if anything, it would be the different types of people that you met. Mm-hmm. Not that I was in a foreign country, but England always was amazing to me, how those people got by with just absolutely nothing. But to meet people from all over the United States, and we had some Polish, the ones from the Free Poland that had come over to England to get in the service. We had some Canadians. Oh, it was, I think that probably had the biggest impact.
All right. This is kind of a broad question, but how would you sum up your service?
I didn't mind doing it, but I wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Would you encourage your other family members in the future now to join the military or not?
Well, I had a daughter that she was a CPA. Out of school, she taught high school math for a while and became a CPA, and decided that she'd had enough of that, and so she went back to school and became a nurse. Mm-hmm. And we were talking one day, and I said that she was sad how she didn't really like working in a hospital and so forth. I said, well, why don't you join the service and become in the Navy or whatever, you know, and become a nurse in there. I says, that way you'd be able to, she was single, and I says, you would be able to see a lot of the country and meet a lot of new people. And I says, I'm sure that the hospital life would be different than what it is in civilian life. And she couldn't go through what it took to do it, you know, like going to enlisting or whatever. But I don't think I would encourage my son to go.
Yeah.
Not unless there was a crisis like there was before.
Yeah. All right. Then this is kind of a interesting question. How did you feel about Hollywood's portrayal of the war? How they...
Well, especially the ones where they were flying B-17s, I thought they didn't know quite what they're doing. Yeah. They would fly with full uniform on, you know. And it was kind of freaky.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
The war stories that have now are more realistic than those things.
Yeah. All right, I got kind of an interesting question now. My dad told me to ask you this, and I don't know what it, but he said that you guys were rationed beer, that you got beer for ration sometimes, and that they said that sometimes they'd bring them up in the planes because it was the only cold place to keep them, and I didn't know if that was true or not.
They were never rationed. Beer and, well, liquor or anything was hard to get.
Yeah.
And for example, when we were in Grand Isle, Nebraska, waiting to orders to go overseas, the only thing you could get there was rum. We never had any trouble getting beer. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'd want to take it in an airplane if anybody ever caught you with it.
Yeah, you'd be in big trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as when we were on base, we always had an enlistment club where they had beer. Mm-hmm. One of the favorite tricks of Englishmen were to fill a bottle with urine and kind of color it a little bit and sell it to you for scotch or something. Which I didn't buy.
Yeah.
I don't like scotch anyway.
All right, pretty much ask you all the questions I was going to ask. Is there anything you want to add?
I was going to say something, but I'll wait till that's off before I say it. No, I don't. I was treated very well. The only time that I was mistreated was, that I felt well was anyway, when we were taking bombardier training in Roswell, New Mexico. And we were paired up. They'd give you two guys to go on these little AT-7s that they had that were made into a bomber. And they had what they called a shack. It was in the middle of a target. And that was your target. And the guy that was paired up with me was from Georgia. The instructor was from Alabama. And I was a Yankee. So every time I'd just about get the sight on, the instructor would give me a jab so it would fall off. And I think what made him mad was the first time I dropped a bomb, I hit the shack. And he just couldn't stand to have me. And that was part of the time that I got washed out, was part of that class.
Yeah.
No, I was treated very well. In fact, Colonel Rader, who had started flying his airplane, I couldn't ask for more. In fact, when I got married, he had his staff car go up with me, get Marianne and her family, and bring them down to the reception place and the wedding of the church. That was something else, too. She was an Episcopalian, or an Anglican.
Yeah.
So we were married in an Anglican church, and we had to go down and talk to the priest, have him post the banns, which is read every once a week for 3 weeks. Yeah. So if anybody had any objections, they could say so. And when we went down there, Marion's family or her folks went with us. And the priest told him, he says, Marion, he says, if you hadn't brought your family with you, your mother and father with you, I wouldn't marry you. Because there were so many of them that